out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Tuesday the 29th of October 2019 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioarian.com. Well, I am extremely pleased to say that we have our most esteemed nationalist elder, Mr. I, who so many of you have been saying you've really been enjoying listening from. He's proving to be one of the most popular guests that we've ever had on the site, I think. So I'm very, very pleased to welcome him back today. Mr. I, thank you for coming on. And how are you doing today, sir?
Very well, thank you. And today I intend to talk about Sir Oswald Mosley and the British Union of Fascists. Now, Sir Oswald Mosley Baronet, as his title suggests, was a member of the aristocracy. And as such, he could easily trace his ancestry back. And normally, with British aristocrats, it begins with the Norman invasion. But he did one better. He can trace his back to one Arnold, a Saxon noble. So he's really an established Englishman. He had his life, of course, as a young aristocrat, went through the usual thing, a public school education at Winchester, and then a commission in the 16th Lancers, and the usual sort of social round that those people enjoyed in Edwardian England. Of course, that came to an end with the start of the First World War, when, of course, his unit was sent to the Western Front, where, of course, they had to fight as dismounted cavalry, because the machine guns put an end to any hope of cavalry being used. And as such, of course, he shared all the horrors of the trench warfare at the time, and that had a lasting impression on him. And he also volunteered to join the newly formed Royal Flying Corps, and he had several several flights as an observer over the German lines, and he did then apply to for training as a pilot. Unfortunately, his aircraft crashed in a training flight, and it left him with a permanent limp. He was so disgusted at the way the soldiers returning from the First World War were being treated, unemployment and things like that. And so he decided to enter politics, and of course, naturally, for his class background, in the Conservative Party. He found out that the Conservative Party was not the patriotic party he thought it would be. And so he was approached by Ramsay MacDonald, who was the leader of the Labour Party, to join with them. And he was given the task of preparing a programme to get the British economy back on its feet and to try and end the unemployment that was growing all the time. And it was known as the Birmingham Proposals. And he put it to the government, and Jimmy Thomas, that's right, that was his name, he was a very brave trade union leader for the Dockers Union, and he was given the job of Chancellor of the Exchequer, which was really, he had no sort of experience to be. And when he mostly put these proposals to him, he just said, oh, the city wouldn't agree to it. So he realised then that the Labour Party was really in the pocket of the financiers. So he left that, and he tried to establish himself as an independent in Parliament. But of course, without the backing of a party machine, it's very difficult to do anything there in that respect. And as time went on, he could see that the growing trouble we were having with unemployment and that would never be solved unless a movement that would act would disregard all the niceties of parliamentary democracy and get on with the job of putting the country back on the seat. And that's how he came to be attracted to Mussolini, who had by that time become dictator of Italy, and of course established all the big public works, like the draining of the Pontine marshes, which eliminated malaria from Italy. And also, he completely reorganised the what were then chaotic railways in Italy. And his opponents always say, well, most Mussolini's only achievement was to make the trains run on time. Well, I think we could do with somebody who could make our trains run on time at the moment. Yeah, so that sort of attracted Mosley to that. And, of course, he found that without a backing of a strong political movement, he wouldn't get anywhere. So he formed the British Union of Fascists. There were a lot of people who came with him were good, experienced people. And the impression that people were given is that they were all thugs and that. But there were really intelligent blokes who had an idea of what to do for Britain. And the idea of it was very controversial about the uniforms that they wore. They, first of all, it was just going to be a black shirt. That was a symbol, and it helped identify them when their meetings were attacked by the Jews and the Reds. And but that got a bit out of hand when they gradually started wearing complete military uniforms. And Mosley often pondered as to whether that was a mistake to let it get that far. But anyway, most of the supporters of the British Union were ex-servicemen from the First World War. And of course it suited them as organised, like the army was, with strict discipline. And there was strict discipline because anybody who did anything that gave the party a bad name were expelled. The matters came to a head really with a meeting at Olympia. Mosley had addressed meetings at the Albert Hall before that, which had a capacity of 8,000. And he was finding that there were hundreds of people were being turned away because of the house was full. So he booked the Olympia Exhibition Hall, which could seat 15,000 people. And that upset the opposition. And they started the Daily Worker and the communist and Jewish newspapers were running headlines like March to Olympia and Smash Fascism. And in the Daily Worker, they were telling people how to travel there by underground in groups, so they got a discount on their tickets and things like that. Well, the meeting took place, and as soon as Mosley started speaking, the Reds got up shouting and trying to throw the chairs about and things like that. And so, of course, he warned them that if they didn't behave themselves, in other words, his black shirts would take action to expel them from the hall. And then the battle took place. Now, there was a lot of remarks in the press afterwards about the black shirts. When there was a spot of trouble in the hall, the black shirts would switch their searchlights on to them to highlight them. But that was quite wrong because the searchlights belonged to the news oil companies. And you know how they ended up. Now, the chap who wrote a book called Friends Apart, he was a well-known left-winger at the time, and he mentioned how he and his friends went to an ironmonger's to be fitted with knuckle dusters for when their intention to attack Mosley's stewards. And they all got thrown out, battered and bruised. The police records at the time recorded that the majority of the injuries, of course, were in fact inflicted on the black shirts. And there was one awful case where a girl received a cut, possibly from a razor. It was obviously more than a fingernail that would do it, from the temple right down her cheek, right down her neck to her back, to her shoulder, which must have been inflicted by a bladed instrument, as they call them today. Because that was always portrayed in the press, that it was the black shirt troubles, and there was lots of calls for the black shirt movement to be disbanded. But all they managed to do was to get a ban on the uniform, which came into place on the 1st of January 1937.
So it was pretty much the same as goes on today then. They were blaming the nationalists for all the violence when in actual fact it had been started by the Reds.
Well, that one handicap the British Union came against as regard to local elections was that only householders could vote. Now, most of the movement consisted of younger people, and the householders would be, middle-aged or elderly, and that proved to be a handicap. In the general elections, the handicap there was the cost of standing candidates, which would involve leaflets being published and things like that. And of course, really, the great majority of our members were working class people who were suffering from poverty. So there was a handicap. And though in the end that didn't really matter because the next election was due in 1940, but of course the moment the Churchill came into the Parliament, he prolonged the life of Parliament, so the 1940 election never took place. It's always said that it's highly unlikely that in an ordinary situation, Churchill would never have been re-elected. He was disliked in his constituency. And as William Joyce famously quipped, his only following was unpaid tradesmen. As you know, one of his Jewish pals bought off the threat that his stockbroker was going to bankrupt him. Because come the war, there was the Regulation 18B, in which all members of the British Union were rounded up and incarcerated in prisons and concentration camps. Now, a particularly disgusting aspect of that was when Churchill went to the United States after they'd entered the war and took with him an original copy of the Magna Carta, which belonged to Salisbury Cathedral. And he presented it to the American people, and he made about all liberties and all that. This is the man who completely ignored it and imprisoned his opponents without charge or term set. And to a certain extent, the Americans followed suit because they insisted that all American citizens of Japanese ancestry couldn't live within a certain distance of the Pacific seaboard. Now, at the end of the war, those who were affected were able to obtain compensation. But of course, no compensation was made to the British people. And there were awful things happened. There was a chap was an insurance agent, and he was arrested while he was out on his rounds. And course, his wife became very concerned when he didn't come home to lunch, and she managed to get in touch with one of his customers, and she told him that he had been there and was apparently okay. And as time went on and he still didn't come home, she went to the local police station to ask if any accidents or anything had been reported. And they said no, they hadn't heard of anything like that. While all the time, her husband had been arrested under 18B and placed, he was in a cell in the police station. Well, the police sergeant denied all knowledge of him. There was another tragic case, and a chap who was arrested. He had a family, a wife and four children, and of course they were left without any means of support at all, because there was no welfare state in those days. So she went to her home in Northern Ireland to stay with her mother, and during an air raid on Belfast, the whole family was killed, the mother, the daughter and the four children. This chap was let out to attend the funeral, handcuffed on one side to a policeman and a military policeman, and on the other with a prison warder. It's a terrible thing, that is. So these are the sort of things that people don't know, generally don't know about. And you don't hear people giving much attention or sympathy to them, because they were supposed to be traitors. But of course, you see, not only were they traitors at all, in fact, they were the most patriotic people in Britain. And yet they made out that these were the people who would collaborate with Germany should they attack us. I hope it makes you all feel the way that I do about it. About the sympathy that there was for the British Union, going right up to the royal family. Queen Mary, she was totally opposed to their policy against Germany, and her lady-in-waiting and confidant, Dorothy Viscountess Downe, was a member of the British Union, and she was the parliamentary candidate for Guildford. The King himself, he had much of the horror of the royal family at the time. In the First World War, he used to visit France and go right up to the front line and talk with the soldiers in the trenches. And of course, he was totally opposed to another war. And it was thought by some of them that the abdication was not so much to do with Mrs. Simpson, but the fact that if he was king, he might not sign the Declaration of War, which he was entitled to. And the British Union ran a campaign called Stand By the King. And of course, unfortunately, it didn't happen, and he was forced to abdicate. And his unfortunate younger brother, the Duke of York, who had that terrible impediment in speech, that being king was a great burden to him. because that didn't matter to the powers that be. And there were lots of talk of people like Lady Howard of Effingham. She was another ardent supporter of the British Union. And these things are covered up now. Because, as I mentioned earlier, they just wanted people to believe that they were thugs and louts and criminals that supported the PUF. But this is nothing of the kind. I mean, when you think, for example, ex-servicemen, there was General McMahon, who was the a general in the Indian Army, and of course, more famously, Major General J.F.C. Fuller, the British officer who studied the use of, well, he was in charge of the tanks at the Battle of Cambrai, and he put forward the plans which had turned out to be that the Germans adopted, and turned out to be the Blitzkrieg, where tanks would, instead of supporting the infantry, it would be the other way around. The infantry would support the tanks. The tanks would make the breakthrough, and the infantry would follow. So, let's try to think. Oh, yeah, Air Commodore Chamier. He was the highest ranking officer in the RAF, as it had then become. And there was Vice Admiral Powell of the Navy. He was a prospective parliamentary candidate for Portsmouth. Another name, who he wasn't actually a member of the BUF, but he ran the Anglo-German link, which wanted friendship with Germany. That was Admiral Sir Barry Donville. And he was interned under the defence regulations. And I can, you know, thinking back to the days when I first actually saw the black shirts, and that was 1935, when I had a holiday in London visiting my mother's sister, when I first came in touch with the black shirts and witnessed their marches. And people used to turn out and watch them lying in the paper, and hundreds of people would give them the salute as they marched past. But of course, filthy little Jews used to dodge out of the crowd and spit at them. But that was to be expected. But by and large, they were well received. But it's a job to, at this distance, to get to the mindset of the British people. They felt that we were patriotic enough. The average Briton did care about his king and country. But, of course, things are changing. It's difficult to put a finger on it as to how they wouldn't take the strong action that was needed to keep it that way.
So they knew something was wrong there, but they just didn't have the get up and go to get behind Moseley.
That's
and
right, yeah.
Prevent
yeah.
the war. And that's
because
what was needed.
They were the people that were suffering. They were the ones who were suffering unemployment. and the horrible thought that we were likely to lose our position because another war, as it turned out to be, people appreciated, but would be a disaster both for Britain and for Germany. And as for becoming an ally of the Soviet Union, well, that was unthinkable in the early 30s when Stalin was purging all his opponents.
Well, perhaps we could get into the Soviet Union and the alliance with the Soviet Union in the next episode, Mr. I. I'm very grateful for you coming on today. Yeah. That was fantastic. I know our listeners are going to really enjoy this episode. So thank you very much for coming on. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Carolyn Jaeger. God bless and hail victory.